You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
For African peoples, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our children and those yet to be born, for they are the ones that you must teach, and you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation, Ashe. Ashe. Ashe.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Just don't make no sense the way my corn are hurting me. When a man runs his game, Lord knows he sure runs it mean. Four buses gone by for them, and not one gone by for me. Corn are hurting me. When you're black, even waiting ain't easy. Man, here I'm loitering. If I walk, I'm prowling. And if I run, I'm escaping. No, it just don't make no sense the way my corn. I sit, I'm shiftless, but Lord knows I'd be hell to pay. If I look like I even look like I look like I was getting ready to get on my feet someday, everybody be getting in a race to keep me in my place. My brothers be rushing in there to fat mouth me down, and the man is shooting me down, and it just don't make no sense. The way these corns are hurting me. Frown, you're hostile. Smile, you're Tom. Look tired, you're on junk. Stumble, and you're drunk. If I wash, I'm a pimp, and if I don't, I'm a bum. And these feet, well, these feet won't let me be. Gotta be calling or doing you something. Tired of being tired about the way they're treating us. I'm tired of that phony smile they do. I'm tired of feeling myself grinning back too. Tired of not puffing up some lips like I ought to too. And I'm tired of waiting for this bus. And it just don't make no sense. Lord knows. The way these corns are hurting me. Just let them keep it up. They got the nerve to have a moon bus. And they got an underwater bus to explore the seas. If they knew what's good for their heads, they'd put their bread on fixing black folks' feet. 'Cause this bus waiting and these corns aching. Gonna make the meanest head whipping militant out of me the world has ever seen. No, I just. Yeah, I wanna get on. Why you think I'm standing here, huh? Damn right I've been waiting long. Ain't you never heard of rapid urban transportation? Black folks is for is waiting. Waiting for the Supreme Court's latest jive decision. Waiting. Waiting for the man to pick who is qualified. Waiting. sitting in the emergency ward to die. Death don't make no sense to wear my corn. I heard me. I don't get a seat. The revolution is here. You step on his feet, and the revolution is right now. Now. Now.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my sisters and brothers. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. My name is William Rogers, and I am your host. Thank you so much for joining us here this evening. Kind of a rainy day here in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, where we're broadcasting here in our studios. But nevertheless, we are going to have a dynamic and wonderful conversation tonight. And we are looking forward to some stimulating thoughts from many of you in our audience and those of you who may be listening via the internet. This is a call-in format. You can call us at 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. And give us your comments and thoughts on our discussion tonight. We are going to be talking about David Walker's appeal, one of the most dynamic pieces of historical literature that I think that has ever been written. And so tonight we want to look at that. And what we are doing is we are using this occasion, August, as you know, is considered Black August Month. It's sort of a acknowledgement and a commemoration of the countless organizers, activists, and freedom fighters who sacrificed their freedom, their lives, in the struggle for Black liberation. Black August Month has been celebrated for a while now. It takes place during the month of August and was started back in the California prison system back in the 70s with Soledad Brothers, George Jackson, and so forth, by the African freedom fighters who wanted to honor their lives and deaths of Black political prisoners killed by the state, bringing awareness to prison conditions and honor the radical tradition of Black resistance against anti-Black state violence and systematic oppression. And this quote came from their website, which is called Movement for Black Lives. And the website is www.m4bl.org. Again, www.m4bl.org. This is their website, and this is the celebration. So we wanted to look at something along the lines of that idea and the movement and what they're trying to do. And tonight we decided to look at David Walker's appeal and discuss, for instance, his 4 points that he made to what he called the colored citizens of the world. Much of Walker's challenge in that book, his 4 challenges, was to the conditions of the colored citizens of the world is rooted in his disdain for the way Africans had begun to behave among each other and how they had used Christianity to sort of blind themselves as opposed to lead themselves, and how Black preachers were misinforming their audience for their own personal gain. So we decided tonight to talk a little bit about that to see just how critical that was. Again, thank you so much for being on. We opened up with a little piece there by Brother Melvin Van Peebles. It came from one of his Broadway productions. And the name of the song was It Just Don't Make No Sense. And kind of speaks to the whole idea of what the great Fannie Lou Hamer said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And that seems like that's what we always do. We're tired of this, tired of that, tired of this, tired of that. But we've got to change it. Just not enough to be tired. You just got to get out and change it. So tonight I've asked some of our brothers to sisters to come on who wanted to make a comment about David Walker's book. I see that we have, as always, my very good friend, Dr. Bruce Bridges. He's on early. He's coming. He's here. We have asked a couple of the pastoral community folk to come. Hopefully they will show or will come on and talk about this whole idea. So it's very powerful discussion. I don't want to take too much time. I want to get into this because this is real critical. We are a two-hour show, and so we want to make sure we get as much out of this that we can. Normal tradition here at the Black Reality Think Tank, as you know, is to do an ancestral profile. I've decided tonight is to let David Walker be that ancestral profile and not get into necessarily the reading of it, but I want to just get into some notes that can sort of set off the tone of where we want to go tonight as we talk about this piece. David Walker's appeal was basically he delivered a speech before the Massachusetts General Colored Association in Boston back in 1828. And he proclaimed that the dejected, degraded, and now enslaved children of Africa will have, in spite of all of their enemies, to take their stand among the nations of the earth. And he did this before the writing of his appeal. David Walker, who was an African-American, was born a free man in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1796. And as a young man, he traveled extensively through the South, observing the myriad injustices of the slave system. And he settled for a time in Charleston, South Carolina, home of a politically active African Methodist Episcopal Church system that espoused racial egalitarianism and other ideas to free enslaved Africans. In Charleston, as you know, Denmark Vesey's insurrection plot was uncovered back in 1822, resulting in severe repression of independent black churches and thus making autonomous black collective action extremely difficult. By 1825, Walker had moved to Boston, where he joined a politically engaged and organized black community. And late in 1828, he delivered that speech. It was an oration to one of the most prominent local black anti-slavery groups, the Massachusetts General Colored Association. And we've talked previously here on the Black Reality Think Tank about a lot of the work that were being done by our ancestors in the city of Boston. Boston was critical in terms of abolitionism, fighting back to Africa, and all kinds of other different ideas that had aroused during that time. Undergirding all of that and all of the abolitionist ideas and movement were strong black churches, independent, and particularly the AME, the African Methodist Episcopal System, because the AMEs, as you know, it started in Philadelphia. Philadelphia was also a seedbed of strong abolitionist ideas and movement. So although firm and proud, Walker's speech gave little hint that he was going to write a book. He didn't indicate it. But in that, he talked about his appeal. And he did it in what was called four articles, together with a preamble to the Colored Citizens of the World, which is a unique title to choose as well. You must remember, 1828, slavery was heavy, deep, thick, hardcore. There had been a lot of things that had been witnessed now by this time. This is getting in close to the coming of the Civil War. Many people knew that there was going to be a conflict by 1820s. Used to be called there was a concept that historians created called the gathering storm. They saw the clouds getting thick, and they knew that war was eventually going to come. And so very clearly by this time, slavery was hot in terms of the discussion, in terms of a movement. Brother Timothy, could you silence your mic, please, sir? Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes, sir. No problem.
So it's clear that we need to understand just how heavy that slavery was. Walker himself had written in some of his works some of the horrors that he had seen. For instance, he saw Whitney, as a matter of fact, there was one incident he saw that he wrote about, and he said he saw the owner of a plantation force a woman's husband to take a stick and beat her until she lost her baby. And at that point, when he beat her so bad she lost her baby, he then killed him too. And this is property, but yet they were still this kind of horrendous stuff. And so Walker looked at all of that. And when you look at Walker and when you think about it, he's obviously, as most historians have said and have done in an assessment of David Walker, that he was angry. This was an angry black man. And that's why I played that song today by Reverend B. Peoples saying, "I'm tired." You know, and obviously Van Peoples uses the concept of he was waiting for the bus, but it's still just the idea of waiting. So David Walker was tired. So when the appeal first appeared, it was, without a doubt, the most militant anti-slavery document that had ever been published. I don't think there's any historian can argue that David Walker's appeal was not the most direct, angry document coming from a black man against slavery. Article 1 of this book describes the core features of oppression under slavery, and that's where he talks about some of those incidents that he saw. And he argues that blacks have a duty to resist their oppressors, using violence if necessary. Remember now, 1830, he's calling for violence against the slave owners. Article 2 argues that black ignorance is a key obstacle to a unified fight against racial injustice. And then in Article 3, he exposes the ways in which the white Christian ministry upholds the slave system. And in Chapter 4, he attacks the American Colonization Society's scheme to repatriate free blacks to Africa, arguing that the ulterior motive behind this plan is to remove free blacks from North America so that the blacks who remain will be more securely held in slavery. And that's something we've talked about here at the Black Reality Think Tank, that a lot of that abolitionist movement wasn't really in favor of African people. There were things like this. Now, there were Africans that also were participating in the Back to Africa movement, but that's another twist to it. And tonight we'll discuss that at a future time. But right now, I just want you to think about that, and we'll address that at another time. Slave rebellions and conspiracies had occurred before David Walker's appeal. Now, David Walker's appeal didn't start slave rebellions and conspiracies. They happened before his book was published. Most famously, as you know, was the Haitian Revolution. And then the Denmark-Versailles plot. But it didn't occur. You know, he was turned in before it could take place. Could you please mute your mics, ladies and gentlemen? It's coming across very loud. Okay. So slave rebellions and conspiracies had occurred before the appeal, as we said. David Walker's book was distributed covertly throughout the South. It was done through a very loosely associated interracial, though mostly black, communication network, kind of an underground thing, and ultimately found its way into the hands of the enslaved and their allies. When Southern officials learned of the book, the response was swift. A bounty was immediately placed on David Walker's head. Georgia and South Carolina passed laws against incendiary publications. Georgia made the circulation of such documents a capital offense. North Carolina and Georgia prohibited the teaching of slaves to read, and a number of Southern states prevented free blacks and slaves from interacting and blacks from assembling at all with white supervision. Walker was well aware of the very dangers involved in publishing such a document, obviously, because 1828, when the slavery was hot, cotton was making money, everybody was getting rich, and then you're going to take their property away like that? Never happened. Well, obviously, there's going to be a swift response to something like that. And he noted in the text of his book that he expected that some would act to imprison or even kill him, that he was willing to die in the effort to free his people from bondage. The appeal was in its third printing in 1830 when Walker died, probably due to tuberculosis, some said, but you cannot rule out foul play. The appeal is not a formal treatise per se. It was kind of like a rallying cry. It was like a manifesto, closer to a sermon than to a learned disputation. It was filled with indignation and laments, had a lot of sarcasm in it. Its rhetoric suggests that it was meant to be delivered orally to an audience rather than read privately. Its primary objective, however, was to raise consciousness and provoke action. A secondary aim was to refute Thomas Jefferson's speculation about the natural inferiority of blacks and his claim that American slavery was milder and more benevolent than the ancient slavery of Egypt, Greece, or Rome. A book that we had talked about here at the Black Reality Think Tank many times was Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia that he wrote in 1787. In one of his queries, Query 14, was a key source of a lot of Jefferson's racist ideology, making the former president, in David Walker's eyes, an enemy of the blacks. As I told you, Jefferson even had the nerve to go into why the African was dark. He said that his bile duct had disrupted, and the feces had seeped from the bile duct through his skin, making him look and smell the way he did. Contrary to Jefferson's assertions, David Walker insisted that blacks in the United States had been treated worse than any other people in the history of the world. Now, here's a black man saying this in the midst of the 1800s, and we can't even get black folks today to stand up and talk about the mistreatment because they're fearful of what might happen to him. The American slave system was nakedly exploitive. Blacks were excluded from all positions of honor, as you know, in authority and public trust. They were denied the right to own land or do anything. We know that history. But I just want to mention it, the fact that this is the system that we're talking about. They were prevented from acquiring even the most rudimentary education. The slave trade broke up families, separating husbands from wives, parents from children. Whites were cruel and violent toward blacks, even murdering them in cold blood, as we've talked about many times here. And to add insult to injury, many of the whites claimed that blacks were subhuman and that God had created the dark race to be the servants of whites. Many books are written that state that. Still around, still available. We've talked about a book here where it was passed out in a Bible college called The Negro, a Beast. In view of that record, Walker proclaimed that white Christians, from antiquity to the present, were the most unjust, greedy, cruel, and tyrannical people on earth. Very hypocritical, he said. Walker was sharply critical of the role that white Christian preachers played in the reinforcing the institution of slavery by, for instance, teaching those that are in captivity that it was their duty to obey their masters, or invoking the curse of the descendants of Ham. Even when blacks had become Christians, he noted they still were not granted the same rights as whites. Moreover, now this is David Walker looking at Christianity. Moreover, the profession of Christian faith, with his command to treat others as one wished to be treated by a people who kept blacks enslaved, was pure hypocrisy. Whites had effectively turned the Christian gospel into an instrument for subjugating others. And that's what we want to talk about tonight. Nevertheless, Walker remained a devout Christian. He was a Christian. He was rooted in the evangelical, egalitarian system of the AME Church. He insisted that Christ's message is universal and should be taught to all peoples across the globe, regardless of race. And in fact, David Walker put Christian theology to liberatory ends. Basically, David Walker was the first black liberation theology preacher, proponent, philosopher that there was, even suggesting that God was literally speaking through him. He repeatedly warned whites. He warned them of God's impending wrath on them for their crimes, and he often referred to blacks as God's people. However, African Americans were God's people not because they were black, but because they were oppressed, and God is a God of justice who punishes the unjust and protects the faithful. David Walker was foretold the coming of a black Messiah who would unify and redeem the African race. That's David Walker. David Walker felt that there was going to be a black Messiah who would come, unify, and redeem the African race. The appeal was addressed explicitly to Africans. But it is clear that the book was also written for whites. It was in part a combination that urged whites to become just before God took his vengeance, probably in the form of a violent black insurrection or a civil war. Although Walker encouraged whites to mend their ways, he doubted that many would do so. He thought that whites had been corrupted by arrogance and racist ideology, and he spoke of them as having a hardened heart like the biblical Pharaoh, who refused to free the people of Israel. In more measured passages, Walker referred to the oppressors of black people as white slaveholders and their abettors. But at times, in a lot of his writings, he wrote as if all whites were oppressors, frequently referring to them as devils and natural enemies of blacks. However, these unqualified verbal assaults were invoked merely for rhetorical purposes. But Walker explained white depravity not as an inherent trait, but as the result of correctable pride and greed. In fact, he welcomed the assistance of white abolitionists, provided, though, they were not associated with the American Colonization Society. And it is clear that he received such assistance with the publication and the circulation of his book. Now, Walker did not find whites alone blameworthy for black oppression. He also harshly criticized blacks whom he felt were servile, treacherous, and cowardly, and therefore complicit in their own oppression. He regarded ignorance as the principal cause of these vices. What blacks were ignorant of was not so much their group history or national color, but God's will. In particular, they did not properly understand the divine moral law. Many failed to recognize that whites had no right to hold them in bondage or to treat them as less than equals. Among the negative consequences of such ignorance were that the blacks were made more vulnerable to pro-slavery propaganda, that they were prone to self-hatred and servility. Does that sound familiar, my brothers and sisters? That destiny or disunity was easily fostered, and that some were misled into collaborating with the enemy. Educated blacks should remedy this widespread lack of moral knowledge, he said, among their people. He said they had a duty to educate the young and the benighted. And one of the ways that Walker would have them carry out this obligation was to circulate the appeal among or read it to those who couldn't read, as an urgent message. He does not appear to have been concerned that this stance was elitist or condescending, or that differences in the status between free blacks and those that were enslaved would undermine the collective effort. Indeed, the appeal encouraged all blacks, those enslaved and free, to work together to end their oppression at the hands of whites. He argued that the abolition of slavery was a necessary condition for blacks anywhere to have freedom, prosperity, and dignity. Let me say one more time. We are talking about 1830. 1830, this was all occurring. Walker held that there was an absolute duty to fight against injustice, and that being oppressed was no excuse for shirking it. He said, the man who would not fight under our Lord and Master Jesus Christ in the glorious and heavenly cause of freedom and of God ought to be kept with all his children or family in slavery or in chains to be butchered by his cruel enemies. This is a brother that's angry, and he's writing with a pen. He's writing with a pen, using his pen as a sword. Moreover, he advocated for the use of political violence if whites refused to change their ways. Indeed, he pointed out that the right to revolt against an unjust regime is asserted in Thomas Jefferson's own Declaration of Independence, 1776. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations and other kinds of invariable ideas, the same object inventions are designed to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such a government. And so he goes on to proceed in a very philosophical way. And in considering the legacy of the appeal, some commentators have described it as the founding black nationalist document. It is the original. There is some truth in this now, but it is also misleading. And here's why. First of all, the appeal was antedated by a few months by Robert Alexander Young's lesser-known nationalist-oriented publication called The Ethiopian Manifesto. A lot of us haven't heard of the Ethiopian Manifesto, but it is also a very powerful document. It was issued in defense of the black man's rights in the scale of universal freedom, 1829. The Ethiopian Manifesto, Robert Alexander Young. We talked about this publication once here. We didn't get into detail, but it's very critical. Most importantly, to see the appeal as only a black nationalist document would miss that it is also a key text in a different tradition of African-American political thought. The black nationalists such as Martin Delaney, Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, have regarded America as an incorrigible white supremacist nation and thus have urged those of African descent to work together to build a separate black nation. But there is a tradition sometimes called integrationists that, while also favoring black solidarity, has insisted that such solidarity be used to transform the United States into a true democracy where blacks and whites can live together on terms of equality and mutual respect. The canonical figures in this latter tradition include Frederick Douglass, W.B. Du Bois, and Martin Luther King Jr. Walker did not advocate black immigration to Africa either, or to anywhere else. He insisted that the United States was blacks' home and native land, and that they had as much right to remain in the country as did whites. He made no unambiguous call for black collective self-determination in North America, at least not beyond, you know, urging political solidarity based on a common oppression and a commitment to overcome it. He did claim, however, that Egypt was the cradle of civilization. This is David Walker now again, 1830. He did claim that Egypt was the cradle of civilization and that the ancient Egyptians were black or color, long before Sheikh Anta Diop. However, this was meant to rebut the charge by Jefferson, among others, that blacks had made no great achievements and to build a sense of pride in a group that was constantly deintegrated. The publication of David Walker's appeal in itself makes it very clear that Walker favored open political protests. And although he defended violent rebellion and explicitly rejected tactics of accommodation, he nevertheless engaged in moral persuasion and called on whites to repent. In terms of fundamental political values, Walker was not a racial separatist. We have to be clear that. He believed racial reconciliation in America was still possible and desirable. Treat us like men, and we will be your friends. And there is not a doubt in my mind that the whole of the past will be sunk into oblivion, and we yet under God will become a united and happy people. And as you understand that, you can begin to see a little bit of some of the workings of people like Booker T. Washington and some of the others behind him that were thinking along those lines. You know, our condition of a captivity is the kind of thing that creates these various ideas and ideologies. That's why you can't just attack everybody if they have one way of life or do one thing or believe in one way. Because oppression, like the type we had to endure, creates this kind of confusion. The whites may say it is impossible, but remember that nothing is impossible with God, said Walker. But it should be added that Walker insisted that this reconciliation could not and should not occur until blacks and whites were treated as equals and the nation acknowledged its past injustice. And so David Walker's appeal was issued. There are many historians who say that his book encouraged Nat Turner and his revolt, that Nat Turner did read David Walker's appeal, and it very well may have been used in what he wanted to do. And you must remember, and I think the brother that did the movie of Nat Turner, and I do use him because there hasn't been a real good written publication on Nat Turner except maybe the book by Herbert Aptheker that he wrote on Nat Turner. But you remember Nat Turner was preaching that whole idea about the religion and Christianity and love of God and so forth and all of that, and you know, and talking about our wretched state and Ham and a lot of those things. And Nate Parker brought some of that out in the movie, and as we listened to some of his sermons, I don't know how much of that was fiction and how much was actually documentation that he got. But he, after a while, he knew it wasn't going to work. Like most people began to realize, this is not going to work. We're going to have to go to something different. And so many times in our history, we go back and we look at our ancestors, they've had to make those changes like that in midstream. They've turned from being as integrationists to more black nationalists. And in some cases, they've turned from being black nationalists back to integrationists again. I think about my dear brother, Eldridge Cleaver, and Julius Lester, and some of those that ended up going back to being Jews, and some of those ideas. And the question becomes, why? What is it? So anyway, I think the whole idea is very revolutionary and frightening. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up and go into our audience. But before I go, I just want to make one thing clear. And a lot of what I'm saying, and I think the significance of David Walker, a lot of the type of exploitation that we as African people and our ancestors encountered, a lot of it wasn't haphazard. It was set up like that. It was justified. It was based on laws and principles and ideas. People wrote books talking about why slavery was good. And we must remember that as we begin to now talk about trying to erode some of the ramifications from all of that. These were philosophical systems. The philosophers, those white philosophers of Europe, had turned a lot of the ideas of enslavement and oppression into systems of philosophy. There are books written about that. People like John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, they wrote books that slavery was good. You need it. Karl Marx, you know, in his stuff. you know, he might have objected to using that system of slavery that we knew about, but he didn't object to the oppression that black people incurred. Like one brother wrote a book, and I'll use the word because I just want to stress the point. He wrote a book called How Many Niggers Did Karl Marx Know? And because of the fact that Marx, you know, spoke against slavery. But the point I'm making is that there's tons and tons of literature arguing on the justification of slavery. These are books coming later. They're not just books from behind. Everybody has gotten to this subject and gotten into the idea of how to take a look at slavery and how to understand it. You know, some of what you would call the great European minds of philosophers have all written about slavery. There are tons of books on that. And we must understand how to deal with that. Aristotle felt that this was natural in doing this. And so what David Walker did was he was the first African-American to attempt to put this to paper and rationalize it in the opposite direction and put it to the point where he could oppose it very clearly. But tonight I want to talk about Walker's critique of the black church and his critique and some of the critique that follows about the black church. And the reason that I want to do this, because as a historian, and I've been studying intense history since the 1970s, and there has not been an institution anywhere in America that has not been more powerful in terms of our revolution and our fight for justice than the black church. And I'll stand on that. But however, there are some things that need to be addressed. There are some things that we need to look at. There are some things that have happened that cause us to need to take a look. And I think that's what Walker saw. Walker saw preachers who were just jokes, who were all up into the white world's face and doing things that were contrary to our liberation. And everybody's written about it. Carter Woodson wrote a book called The History of the Negro Church in America. Said the same thing. Talked about the black church. Du Bois, even though he was kind of an agnostic, or if not right out atheist, spoke very hard on black preachers not using the resources in the way that need to be read. But then there were other situations where they did. John Rushworm, Allen. Rushworm started, through the black preacher, started the first newspaper in America called Freedom Journal. So there were some soldiers that were coming out of the church that were fighting. But then at the same time, there was some silly stuff. And there's still silly stuff going on right now. So I want to open up our lines and deal with that. Again, this is the Black Reality Think Tank. I'm your host, William Rogers. Our call-in number here is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Just give us a call, questions or comments that you might want to have. So as always, I always go to my good brother, Brother Dr. Bridges first, and kind of like, because he has been a very big help in supporting a lot of the historical perspective based on the fact of his teaching experience in the university. He's been a big help with me, so I appreciate that. So I kind of want to get his position first, and then I want to move to our clergy brothers who have agreed to come on and talk with me about a lot of this as well and get their perspective on it. So, Dr. Bridges, how you doing tonight, my friend?
Oh, man, it's hot down here, man, about 97, 98 degrees in Durham, North Carolina.
Wow. It's raining here.
So, and my air went out, but I got a fan blowing like the old days.
I got you. So, David Walker's appeal, what's your take?
Yeah, you pretty you kind of covered it quite a bit, Dr. Rogers. But David Walker's appeal was revolutionary. Mm-hmm. It was definitely revolutionary, and really, when you look at African Senate theology, because that's what his book really was, as you talked about, he quoted the Old Testament of the Bible in all four of those articles, which if, you know, if we had time, you can get back to him, I'll get to it, but I can talk about some of those. But each one of his articles, he talked about those, about the Old Testament of the Bible. And as one of the two basic institutions used by the mill oppressors of our people, the church and other religious institutions, they probably wield a stronger hold on African minds than do so-called education institutions. And historically, when we look at African-American people, they've used the Bible as a source of their inspiration to free themselves from slavery. And David Walker was no different. He definitely used the Bible. And see, other than the master's old books on European history, this was the only book accessible to the enslaved people. The Bible is the only book that was accessible to the enslaved people. Mm-hmm. Other than, like I said, the other the master's books on European history. And though many had heard of the freedom fighter, like you mentioned too in your discussion of Haiti and Toussaint Louverture, the African in this country, his mind was basically blocked. And locked away from anything that hindered freedom. They made sure to keep us away from any freedom. And in the world we live in today, of course, now African Americans have more access to information than ever before. I mean, you got bookstores, museums, satellite television, newspaper, the internet, but still, with the availability of all this information, there's absolutely really no reason at all for the black mind in Africa or in America to be unaware of its incarceration.
That's right.
It's really not. And so when we look at David Walker, I wanted to kind of talk about David Walker being from Wilmington, North Carolina. And when we look at the geography of it, Wilmington was at one time the largest city in the state of North Carolina. And it was a port city. As you said in your discussion also, David Walker left Wilmington, went to Charleston, South Carolina, and then went up to Boston, Massachusetts. And when you look at it, all three of those cities, and of course David Walker traveled in various other areas too of the country, but basically along the east coast of the United States. But when you look at these major cities that David Walker traveled in, they were all port cities. And there's a reason for that. Boston is a port town,
right.
Or was a port town, still
right.
Is. Wilmington in New Hanover County in North Carolina, port city. Charleston was a port city.
Mm-hmm.
And port cities tended to be towns or cities that would always bring people in from various parts of the world. There was a tremendous amount of diversity being in a port city.
That's
because
true.
You have the military there, naval bases, and you have people coming in on ships because it's cities located along waterways give you direct access to other nations outside of the United States,
right.
As opposed to states and cities in the interior of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very, very important.
Right.
And David Walker, in his appeal, he appealed to people along the East Coast, and when he went to Boston, he had a, what I guess you might say, something like a secondhand store or a thrift store. And as the story goes, David Walker would take these little writings that became the articles of the appeal and write these little articles by hand and write the articles on paper and put them inside of the, let's say, a pocket of a sport coat or the pocket of a pair of pants that you might buy in a thrift store, and you get home with your suits or your sport coat or your pants, and you say, what's on this piece of paper? And then you open up that piece of paper, and it was one of the articles of the appeals. Mm-hmm. And this was one way that David Walker distributed his information that he was writing that eventually became the appeals.
Right. That's exactly right.
Very unique way of distribution. And David Walker also worked with the Freedom's Journal. I don't know if you mentioned that or not. I might have missed it. But he mentioned he worked with the Freedom's Journal, which is the first owned and operated black newspaper in the United States of America. But in Walker's, and as you also mentioned, I'm just repeating, David Walker was born free because his mother was a free woman. And, of course, you know, the way the United States Constitution was written, he was free because his mother was free. But another good point I wanted to reiterate, too, is that David Walker David Walker was a student of history. Student of history.
Yes, he was.
Because he mentioned
yes,
the Egyptians were Africans. In Article 1 of the appeal, he talked about the Egyptians being Africans or colored people, as he said. And he said some of them were yellow and others might have been dark, a mixture of Ethiopians and the natives of Egypt, about the same as you see the colored people of the United States of today, just various shades and colors of one people. And he mentioned that in his appeal, page 18 of the appeal. Mm-hmm. And David Walker also being a student of history as well as philosophy, he maintained that African people were extremely ignorant about their condition due to slavery and colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
And in Article 2, he talks about the ignorance, and I'm quoting him too, he talks about the ignorance of my brethren. He said that this ignorance is a mist low down into the very dark and almost impenetrable abyss of which our fathers for many centuries have been expunged.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not having as much access to knowledge as preachers of today, Walker does state that learning originated along the Nile and that it was then carried into Greece. So the point that you made, I'm just reiterating the point you made.
Right.
He understood that the knowledge came. He was well learned. You know, he said that the knowledge originated along the Nile and then carried into Greece. And he continues discussing how the Romans then passed that knowledge to other parts of the world,
mm-hmm.
which is what we talk about today when we talk about stolen legacy and we talk about ancient African civilizations.
Right. Right.
But Walker knew about it then.
1829.
And, that's right. That's why I'm just kind of going over some things you said, but which is very important. Around 1829, good you're doing this in Black August, because I think he's supposed to have been found dead around August the 6th, 1830. And his birth year was kind of shaded. Nobody really knew exactly where it came from. But he says in Article 2, he urged people to enlighten that brethren. In other words, he says, if I know something, I should pass it on to you, or you should pass it on to other people that you know. And he says, I call upon you, therefore, to cast your eyes upon the wretchedness of your brethren,
right,
and to do your utmost to enlighten them, like you're doing on the Black Rapture Think Tank. Go to work and enlighten your brethren. Let the Lord see you doing what you can to rescue them and yourselves from degradation.
Already.
And that's David Walker's appeal. That's page 40. And due to the condition now of ignorance and degradation of African people in the world today, it's absolute necessity that those who are enlightened pass that light on to those who are ignorant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and I can go on, because I went through all the articles of appeal, and you got some other people, but in article number 3, he talks about, and then I'll stop at number 3 because it hits right home at what your program is about tonight. Article 3 of the appeal of David Walker is entitled, Our Wretchedness and Consequence of the Preachers of the Religion of Jesus Christ.
That's right. That's right. You sure did.
Our wretchedness. Listen to it now. Our wretchedness and consequence of the preachers of the religion of Jesus Christ. David Walker questions the way in which religion is practiced by Europeans and their descendants.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes the following statement. Indeed, the way in which religion was and is conducted by Europeans and their descendants, one might believe it was a plan fabricated by themselves and the devils to oppress us. But hark, my master has taught me better than to believe it. He has taught me that his gospel, as preached by himself and his apostles, remains the same, notwithstanding Europeans have tried to mingle blood and oppression with it. And that's the appeal, page 47.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so David Walker took the Bible and reinterpreted it. And during that time, of course, they weren't using the term liberation theology. But he was teaching what Cone taught, what, hundreds of years later, James Cone and other liberation theologians, Jeremiah Wright,
and
other liberation theologians.
That's exactly what he did. That's exactly what he was
and
doing.
And like you kept emphasizing, which is good, you emphasized it. We talking about 17, 97, 98, 99, right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just after the American Revolution, he was doing this.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So he was way ahead of me.
How much of your research did you know about the Ethiopian Manifesto and that work on Robert Alexander Young?
I heard you mention it in your presentation.
Right.
I read it a long time ago. It's been a long time. And I said, oh, he mentioned it. I hadn't thought about it in a long time. So
right.
It's been a while. I did, but I definitely know about it.
Yeah, I want to talk about it one day on our program. I'm going to pull some resources and learn about it because this is
That'd
also...
be good because I think I have a copy. Yeah, right. It's an old book, you know.
Okay, yeah, it's old. It's real old.
Yeah. Uh huh.
And he wrote this.
David Walker. And in terms of Walker, when you read his biographical information, you don't see much about how it is that he came into this knowledge. That's why I wanted
right,
to mention
right.
it.
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
That's right. That's why I mentioned in my preamble from the very beginning, Boston, Wilmington, Charleston, South Carolina, in the same way that human beings travel to and through port cities from other places in the world, information, knowledge,
right.
Comes through the same way. See,
right.
So,
okay.
And that's what made Wilmington later on. I'm jumping forward a little bit to the Wilmington Massacre of 1898. When the Wilmington Massacre of 1898 occurred, black people were the majority of the population at Wilmington. They were 90% of the barbers. They were running the city council, the
right,
city government,
right.
The mayor. You see, and so being near the East Coast or West Coast or near the water.
A
waterway,
right? Mm-hmm.
Right. It not only brings people there; it brings ideas and information and news in that you don't get in the interior of a landmass.
Right, and that's why.
So
that's why New York is the biggest city in America because of the waterways. It's that water. New York is the only state that has a flat coastline where those big ships can pull up there. Without having to dock way out in the middle of the ocean and then catch boats to the shore. In New York, you can pull those big ships right up to the docks. And that's a lot of people don't understand. That's why the longshoreman industry is so important in New York, because those ships, the coastline, the New York coastline can hold those ships. Most coastline can't hold those ships. The ships are too big to park on the coastline.
That's right.
Yeah.
And in the same way in New York you get products from Arabia, you get products
right.
from Africa, you get products
mm-hmm.
from India. But in the same way you get those physical material products, you're also getting access to information and knowledge.
There we go.
You see.
There we go.
And news, you see. So this is probably how David Walker was so astute, because he had been exposed to so much information other than what was to be found in Wilmington, North Carolina. Port cities, there's a lot to be said about port cities, and I could talk more about the geography, but that's very important.
Exactly.
So anyway, you can come back to me. I just wanted
to come back.
That.
Okay.
And,
I hope, I know you said you were going to ask Dr. Maxwell to come on. I'm not sure if he's on yet. I don't see his name. But if not, Reverend Rogers, I asked him to come on. I'm not sure if he's on either, but I'm going to.
I'm on.
Fantastic. Great. Okay. Well, I'm going to take a quick break. We're at the top of the hour. I'm going to come right back, and I'm going to get into some of the our pastoral family and ask them what their opinion is and what they think about this. Let's take a quick break.
I want to talk to my gangbanger family. You make it very difficult for me.
Go ahead, say that.
In the 60s, we knew who the enemy was. But in 2007, you're the enemy. It's black people killing black people. Black people robbing black people. Black people raping black people. I'm talking to you. You gangbangers know the principle of retaliation, but you are retaliating on the cheapest of principles. You are not retaliating because of oppression, injustice. You are retaliating because you don't like the color that your brother is wearing. You don't like the gang that he's a part of. You don't like the area of the city that he comes from. And he may be encroaching upon your drug market. So you retaliate. We are not talking about that. And I cannot call for retaliation in matters of the slain when you have become the number one slayers of yourself and your own people.
No one knows who the Son of God is except the Father in heaven. And no one can know who the Father is except the Son and those to whom the Son will reveal him. Until now, you haven't known him as I do, but I have come, sent from him to you.
Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter? Or in your head? Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head?
I ain't Jesus, but I understand where Jesus was coming from. I can feel his passion because it is mine to be blessed in the womb of this earth and nurtured by the trees, the animals, the sun, the moon, and the stars, to be touched by them and dance in the rhythm of nature's flow. Oh, what a joy. I ain't Jesus, but I too am displeased with man's inhumanity to man, with the very thought of taking a life, turning and twisting it into a callous plant that hides from the sun and curses the stars at night. The wicked howl of madness finding residence in our souls makes the dark side bright and desirable.
Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head? Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head?
No, I ain't Jesus, but I love a good song. Fried fish on Friday, some real poetry, a great basketball game, watching black people rise and take charge of their lives and cherish the ancestors and the children we see every day and recognize even a fool may have something wise to
say. Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head? Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head?
And I'm working on my freedom. I'm working on my freedom every day. No, I ain't Jesus, but I know I can be an angel.
Is he the living God, or is he dead? is he in the gutter or in your head? Is he the living God or is he dead? Is he in the gutter or in your head? Is he?
Listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All right, we are back, my sisters and brothers. This is the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Central Time. To 9 p.m. We thank you for joining us. We have a call-in format for those of you who may be listening via the internet and would like to call with your comments or questions, 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. And we appreciate that little closing piece there by the last poets called The Living God. And kind of fits into our topic tonight. We're talking about the great David Walker, one of the first black nationalist, black liberation theology publications ever created in America. And we wanted to look at that. And we're looking at it and based on the period of time this is. This is August. It's referred to in our movement as Black August. It's an acknowledgement time and a commemoration of the countless organizers and activists and freedom fighters who have sacrificed their freedom and lives in the struggle for black liberation. And so we have this Black August celebration to pay tribute to that. Black August takes place during the month of August and was started based on the California prison movement. In the 1970s with the Soledad brothers, George Jackson, Angela Davis, and so forth, and a lot of those other freedom fighters who wanted to honor the lives and deaths of black political prisoners killed by the state to try to bring awareness to prison conditions and honor the radical tradition of black resistance against anti-black state violence and systematic oppression. No, we are not living with chains on our feet on the plantations that we think about when we see, but there are plantations still in America. They are called Attica, Sing Sing, Walpon, and all the hundreds of correctional facilities that's owned by the federal government. These are the new plantations. These are the new hellholes of America. And the same conditions that were going on during the time of the 1800s, at the time that David Walker was writing, the time that Nat Turner was planning his movement, these are the same conditions that are going on right now in these prisons of America. There are a lot of our brothers and sisters that are locked up as political prisoners. You've heard us here on the Black Reality Think Tank talk about the carceral state and its condition. We've had guests. We had a brother, an attorney, on maybe back probably about a year ago named Attorney Dan Fodio, who was representative of a very powerful political prisoner who is still incarcerated at this moment. Dr. Bridges has often spoke of him and ask us as an audience, as a people, not to forget them. the brother out of Philadelphia that's been there for ages. We asked you not to forget them. A lot of them are ill. A lot of them are living under very hard conditions. And so even though we are talking about David Walker and the plantation system, that same system exists on another level. A lot of our young people, our young men, our young women are incarcerated in those systems right now. And they are living under some horrid conditions. We had a sister that came on not too long ago to talk about her son being locked up in one of the federal prisons of North Carolina in the midst of all of this COVID and some of the things that are going on. So tonight we just want to make sure that you don't forget that and that we make that historical connection between the time of David Walker and the time of right now. And we'll, any of you want to mention some of that later on, you're welcome to do so. Reverend Rogers, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Dr. Rogers. How are you tonight?
Okay,
I asked
good.
Dr. Long to call in and Dr. Maxwell as well. They may be on the line.
Okay, maybe they might be. There are some Carolina calls on here that I don't recognize the number, so I will call after you finish. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on and participate in this from the clerical position. The black church has taken some hard hits of recent. Many of our nationalist brothers and sisters don't want anything to do with it. They feel that it has hurt our people, that it continues to hurt our people. They feel that it puts us to sleep. It tells us to wait by and by and get our pie in the sky later. Malcolm talked about it. Many others talked about it. But as I said to earlier, I am of that school of thought that it has been the most powerful institution operating for African people in America. There's nothing in it has been any stronger that I know of. And if you do know of someone, then by all means indicate it. But very clearly, even the revolutions that occurred of Nat Turner, Denmark Brasset, Gabriel Prosser, and the Haitian Revolution came out of religious ideology. So what do you think, Reverend Rogers, is this confusion? What is it, or do you see it as a confusion among our people that's calling us? Because if we are thinking that way, then we're losing the one institution that historically has been a salvation. What are your thoughts on that? How do you see that as a clergy?
One of the things that I wanted to bring out was that David Walker said he went to a camp meeting in Charleston, South Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And he heard the preacher say, slaves obey your masters.
Right.
Now, one of the things we have to remember is that any religious book can be twisted and thwarted by the enemy to control people. Any religious book, not just the Bible, any religious book.
Okay.
And if it's interpreted wrong, if it's taught wrong, and you must understand that the first preachers were taught by white preachers. And because of that, when you're talking to slaves and you say slaves obey your masters, of course that means black people need to obey the white man.
Right.
But in the reality of the word master simply meant one who had knowledge, one who had understanding and wisdom. We have people that we call master masons, not because they own people, but because they have the knowledge. We have people who are masters in their prospective areas of thought and study, not because they own slaves. Even Master Farad Muhammad, he didn't own slaves. They called him master because he was due to that honor. He was a wise man. He was a man who had knowledge and brought knowledge to our people here in America. So this word master can be twisted and can be contorted into a way to control people. That was the first thing that the Bible was taught wrong to our people. And, of course, the black ministers began to pick that up because they didn't know any better, and they began to teach the same thing. Now, the thing that you spoke of just a minute ago, the black church. After the 60s, the enemy realized that there were three main institutions that were the pillars of the civil rights movement.
Right.
It was the black family, the black university, and the black church. They decided that there were going to be a concerted effort to take down all three of these institutions. We talk about how the black family was destroyed. We talk about how black institutions were destroyed. But nobody understands the attack that the black church had on it. From the time of the early 70s up until now, mm-hmm. there has been a complete attack on the black church. Mm-hmm. And so the black church, as you knew it, and as I knew it, does not exist anymore. There are some churches who are doing great work, but that black church, that concept of the black church was attacked. And it was attacked in various different ways. Mm-hmm. It was attacked in ways that we don't even realize. It was attacked in ways that we were so oblivious to that we did not pay attention to. We always thought that the black church would always be there. We took it for granted that it would always be there. But the enemy knew that the black church had power, it had money, it had people of position. And so they instituted a serious attack on the black church. And this is why the black church is in the condition that it's in today.
That's a good point. And very clearly, we know that, even to the point of physically destroying it, burning it. They had this movement of burning churches in the South, bombing churches in the South.
That was the physical,
right?
That was the physical destruction of the black church. But then they did some things on the inside mm-hmm. of the black church. All of the big gospel preachers that you see on TV today, all the preachers that you see on TV, they didn't come out of the black theological school. They came out of Old Roberts University. They were taught by white preachers. They were taught by these guys that have these mega churches, you call so-called mega churches.
Right.
They didn't come out of black churches. They came with a different philosophy and a different concept in religion. Just like in the time of David Walker, the Bible was and the religion was construed, so it is today.
Powerful. Okay. All right. I'm gonna come back. Is Reverend Long? Are you here? Are you here with us? Reverend Long? Reverend Long? Not here.
Maybe he's not on.
Okay, Pastor Maxwell, are you on? Okay, he's not here with us as well. I know that I had asked one other person. Well, let me do this then. Let me go to my sister, Sister Benisawa. Jan, she and I have talked extensively about this subject over the months and years privately, and we even to the point of talk about doing this type of a broadcast. And even she wanted to do this type of a broadcast and force sort of produce it, that I thought was a good idea. Sister Jan, does Reverend Rogers' answer help you a little bit better in understanding some of the confusion that you had about what the black church was doing?
I want to ask you, first greetings, I want to ask you if you can, I need to call on another phone, so if you can call me back in about, not call me back, but call on me in about 15 minutes.
Okay, sure, I'll do that. I can do that.
All right,
I'll come back to you. Let me go to see if Brother Harry White. Brother White, what are your thoughts about Reverend Rogers' position of the destruction of the black church exteriorly and how those key institutions were deliberately destroyed both interiorly and exteriorly as one of the misguided? Now, obviously, during David Walker's time, there was something else going on. Something of the same type, because during David Walker's time, you had to have permission to have church service on Sunday. And if you did not meet that plantation owner's desires, then you would not be able to gather, because it was a crime to gather. So anybody that gathered during the years of captivity had to have the approval of the master, meaning the owner of that plantation. So that was real carefully judicialized system among that time. So what are your thoughts on what went wrong and how it went wrong?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and to all the family on the show.
Good evening.
I totally agree with what Reverend Rogers said. You see, you can't certify the church because the church is the teachings and the word of God. Mm-hmm. So since you can't ask God, is this his church? Anybody can open up a church and say, I'm a reverend and this is a church. Mm-hmm. And say whatever they want to say. I mean, you've been in Brooklyn. You got churches, two or three churches on every block.
That's true.
So there's no way that you can, because something says it's a church, don't mean it's a church. So any hustler that can open up a storefront and put a sign out there and say, Church of the Holy Faith, Church of the Upper Room, Church of the Holy Ghost, and whatnot, and they can say whatever they want to say. Mm-hmm. You can't walk in there. You can't walk into any church in this country and tell the pastor of that church that he's not a pastor of that church.
That's true.
So for people that you have, people that are sincere and trying to do the work of God and the right thing and serve the community, and then you got hustlers and con artists.
Mm-hmm.
They see it as a business and will say whatever they need to say and fall in line with whoever they need to fall in line with to get what they want.
Right.
And there's no way that you can differentiate, because as long as you put on a dark suit and a white collar around your neck, you can say, I'm Reverend Herbie White.
That's exactly right.
And that's the unfortunate part of it.
Mm-hmm. And even in David Walker's time, those that did get an opportunity to sit in an actual physical building and hold a service had to, as I said earlier, had to have the approval of the plantation owner. If he didn't, he had to go do what history tells us was the invisible church. And the invisible church met out in the woods near the water.
Yeah.
Right.
Something else about David Walker and the pastors of his time, preachers of his time, David Walker knew when he wrote that appeal that they were going to kill him.
Yeah.
He knew that. And he did it anyway.
Right. Exactly. That's the thing. He didn't care. He was angry. He was an angry black man.
Everybody is not going to do that.
Right. Exactly. And that's why a lot of times today you will see the system trying to keep from us some of those atrocities that white people do and are doing now. The reason that cop, Chauvin, is going to get what he got is that they need to silence that. If it had not been, I think, for that woman's camera, he would have possibly walked free.
That David Chauvin thing, George Floyd, was a 9.5-minute excerpt from a 500-year-old video.
Right. I like that. That's exactly right. And so that is attempted. That's why Facebook will shut down ads that if you try to post an ad on Facebook of a lynching, they will take it off. They'll take it down. They stopped me the other day from, I put a picture of it. It wasn't a lynching, but it was a guy, he was chained to a post, and I was using it to promote one of our programs, and they wouldn't let me post it. They kept taking it down. Because they know that will anger people into action. It wakes you up and makes you, do that. I mean, we should have been doing this a long time ago.
That's what critical race theory is.
That's right, and that's why they're scared of that.
Every home should have a copy of David Walker's Appeal.
Everyone.
And they should read it periodically, because as time passes and you get experience, it makes what he says more relevant.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I agree. We have a, I'm going to go to have a caller at 919-224. 919-224, would you like to say something, or are you just listening? 919-224. Okay, just listening. That's fine. What about Morristown, New Jersey? Would you like to say something, or are you just listening, caller? Morristown, New Jersey. Okay, just listen. Brother Timothy, don't forget to
answer. Yes, sir.
What do you think about it? Now, okay, now, let me set this up. Let me set this question up for you up. Okay.
Okay.
Now, you are serving under a black preacher that system is totally operating in a different vein. But even so, they're operating in a different vein, that you got problems with how black folk act in your system, because I've heard the minister chew folk out for doing some of the things that they were doing. What do you think about these critiques about black preachers and the black church being this and doing that? You know, what are your thoughts coming from the framework that you worship under?
Now, am I saying this in the way that the preacher is preaching the wrong thing and saying the wrong thing to the congregation?
Right.
Am I understanding that? Oof. Well, at that point, you know, the word is supposed to be sacred, and the person preaching the word is supposed to make sure that it's the right thing to say and do.
Right.
Now, if the preacher is corrupt, he has to be told, and if not changed, be removed.
Right.
He's not the permanent fixture, you know, and he's not perfect, but we're looking for excellence. So removing and putting the right person there. But I want to say something to you, Dr. Rogers. When I read the appeal, and when I had read it, my teacher, who people used to say was like a father figure to me, and him and I together could talk about black people in a way that would shake people up in our classroom. I was a student in his classroom, and a person that came in to talk about Frederick Douglass, and the appeal came up in a colloquium.
Okay.
And I said that, oh, I recognize David Walker's appeal. And I was in a PWI in the graduate school that was predominantly white. And my professor, who was a colonial writer, Commonwealth from India, who understood and was around end of colonization. And I thought, oh, David Walker's appeal. And people said, what is that? And my professor said, you know, Mr. Han, I want you to write for me a report. And I said, okay, I'll do that. He said, because they don't know nothing about David Walker's appeal. And I said, what I'm going to do is that, yeah, I want to talk about David Walker's appeal and who were the colored people in all over the world in America who's appealing to, and what was he saying. And I said, I was going to take it, and I was going to do a comparison contrast with someone who's an integrationist who they like.
Right.
And I'm going to do a comparison contrast with polemical writing, polemics, the polemics of Douglass' speeches and ways and David Walkers.
Mm-hmm.
That they familiar with each other, but they don't know Walker. And I said, well, Walker is telling the people to and say and do is come together, I think, more in a nationalistic way. And Frederick Douglass is telling the people in a certain kind of way to be integration. Then I said in my report, I said that Douglass wanted integration and Walker wanted separation and nationalism. And I said in my report that guess what? David Walker is correct. And people say, David Walker is correct, we need to be together. I said, but white people never give you social equality. Never see you as his equal.
Okay.
And you don't have to be the most intelligent guy, woman, man or child, to understand that how you get equality if it's yours.
Mm-hmm.
You call the shots.
Right. And see, and that's an important part of what you're saying. That's very important because religion is personal. You know, you can't tell another person how to worship or how they should or should not worship.
So true.
You can't do that. It's, you know, it's personal. That's where it gets confusing, you know, because sometimes we want to try to do it collectively.
That's true.
Yeah, and that's.
But you don't want to be told what to do, and you will be told to do if it's not your land.
Right. Right.
See, but when you have your own independent land, you call shots on your land because you're the landlord. There's a difference.
Exactly.
You understand that when you're being slighted and mistreated. You understand it when you have your own and you're telling people how you feel in your own house. Whether they like it or not, you might have to get out.
Right.
If it's your house.
I agree. Let me ask, let me go over here to Arlington Heights, Illinois. Is anybody, would you like to say something, Carla, or are you just listening? Arlington Heights, Illinois. Just listening? Okay, no problem. Right there. Reverend Rogers. Reverend Rogers, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, all right. Let me ask you this. You made a very profound statement in what you just said earlier. But let's address this. The two areas that I think the black church today gets the hardest critique from our own people is, number one, the turn the other cheek ideology, philosophy. And very clearly, the Bible is not necessarily reflective of turn the other cheek in a lot of ways, particularly Old Testament history and places like that. But very clearly, that's one of the things that's usually grabbed when they critique it. And the other one is the money, the tithing, the big buildings. And I mean, I've even heard James Cone critique that. He said the black church has lost its Sabbath, it's lost its ways trying to build big buildings and stuff, and it's forgot about saving souls, trying to save itself. Then you've heard that because I know I shared it with you one time, that quote from James Cone. Can you address it from that way? Is that an honest assessment to make or use in looking at the church of today?
Yes, it is. There are, again, what I said before, Brother White is absolutely right. When you look at stuff like this, anyone can become a Christian preacher. That won't happen in the Muslim religion. It won't happen in the Jewish religion. But you can be ordained today and have a church next week. Anybody can become a preacher. And then what happened was homosexuals were allowed to get into the pulpit. That won't happen in the Muslim religion. It won't happen in the Jewish religion. And then when that comes into play, then all kind of things begin to happen in the church. When unscrupulous people, hucksters, tricksters, prostitutes, all these types of people who are in now in charge, are part of the religious institution, they see a lot of money coming in and out of the church.
Okay.
And, of course, they're going to put their hands on it. They're going to want money. All of these things are part of the attack that happened on the black church.
I got you.
All of these things began to come into play about 20 or 25 years ago.
I got you.
Maybe a little bit longer, when those things began to happen in the church. And all of these people, these David Walker called them pretend preachers, so-called preachers. He said that if a preacher of the gospel wanted to do any good, he would preach against their oppression and to do the utmost to erase it from the country.
Right.
And that's what the church has forgotten to do. We took on a new concept of religion called prosperity. And when we took on prosperity as a religion, then we forgot about the religious teaching that was handed down throughout the generations that made a people more proud and powerful.
That's true.
And because of that, and other things that have happened in the black church has lost step. It has lost its conscience. It has lost its power. It has lost its attraction to our people, because there are so many things that are being told about the black church. And then there was the black church. There was the black preacher jokes. Black preacher jokes.
Oh,
amen.
Yeah.
There's a lot of black preacher jokes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the stereotypical chicken-eating, biscuit-sopping black preacher joke. You know, we all laugh at that. We all think that's funny, but that's not funny.
Yeah.
It's never been funny.
Okay.
It's never been funny.
Okay.
But we buy into that. We buy into stuff like that. And that has also caused the appeal of the black church to waver.
Right. Right. That's right. Dr. Bridges, I saw you had a book in your bookstore one time. I remember way back when I came in there back in the when I started coming in there in the 90s, called Devil in the Pulpit. Did you ever read that?
Oh, yeah. You mean it was the same thing, but it's called Satan in the Pulpit.
Yeah, Satan in the Pulpit. Right. Okay. What was the deal on that?
It was about a brother from North Carolina named Stoughton Perkins, and he's deceased now. But what he was talking about was Reverend Rogers was talking about, and that is about preachers in the pulpit just hustling and making money. That's what it basically was about, Satan in the Pulpit. As a matter of fact, even before you met me, I had him at my store. He spoke at my store, did a book signing at my store one Sunday on Dillard Street, and that was the basic premise of his book, of how preachers were just hustling and taking advantage of people. And as a matter of fact, Stoughton Perkins was even on just before Oprah came on. Phil Donahue was on Phil Donahue program one morning back in the day. So that's what that's about. And there's a brother too by the name of Jeremiah Kamara, who has a book, and he talks about the black church. Can't think of his name. His book talks about the black church and what the black church should be doing. And you know, Walter Williams talks about it too, somewhat in a very, very, very stressful, distressful, how you want to look at it, manner, when he says that it's all made up. He says it's all made up. But one point I want to make, and when I say all made up, he means in terms of everything that comes from the church and Jesus and even Muhammad and Islam, all that. He says all fictitious, all made up, it never existed. But it was just designed to control the mass of the people. Whatever the case may be, it's going to be here, and I'm a firm believer that it needs to be used to uplift the masses of the people for whatever is going to be done. It's not going anywhere. And the pastors, as Reverend Rogers said, during the 60s, it went through a lot of changes, and a lot of it was cut off a lot of ways from the people because it became nationalistic. We wanted to get away from it because we saw Christianity as a white man's religion. But when you really study it, you'll find that Christianity and Islam are religions that came out of the heads and minds of the settlers by the banks of the Nile River, black people, many years ago.
Right.
And then it was reinterpreted and given to us in that parquet tang type form that we got it in,
you see.
But that's not what it was from the beginning.
Yeah.
It was used, as Reverend Rogers also very eloquently stated, to put us into slavery and to take control of our minds and to have us to follow the master in his way. As a matter of fact, there's a book called Bullwhip Days. And
yeah,
it's subtitled The Slaves Remember, and Oral History of Slavery. And there's a section in Bullwhip Days about religion and education, and it talks about religion from the mouths of the actual slaves themselves. For example, there was a sister by the name of Alice Sewell, and she says, and I'm quoting in her words, talking about the church, she says, they did allow us to go to church on Sunday about 2 miles down the public road, and they hired a white preacher to preach to us. He never did tell us nothing but be good servants, pick up old Moss and old Miss things about the place, and don't steal no chickens or pigs, and don't lie about nothing. Then they baptize you and call that you got religion. Never did say nothing about a slave dying and going to heaven. When we die, they bury us next day, and you is just like any of the cattle on the place. That's all tears to it and all tears of you. You is just dead. That's all. And that's just from one of the slaves, enslaved people, Alice Sewell, about religion. And the way it was taught to us. But that is the interpretation that, as Reverend Rogers said again, that came from Oral Roberts Seminary and came from Southeastern Seminary over in Wake Forest, North Carolina, and other and the Baptist Convention in Nashville, Tennessee. That's the kind of tea. But what they had actually done is taken our history, the knowledge of our people in the Old and New Testament, because, as I always say, the first country ever mentioned in the scriptures of the Bible is Ethiopia in Genesis. The first book of the Bible, before they mention any other country, and that's in Africa. So Africa is threaded throughout the whole Bible, but the way it was given to us to be used as a mechanism of control to keep our people in their places. That's really what it was.
Exactly. And then the other thing, it was very important to remember that most of the leadership that would take place in organized Black America would come out of the church. They would teach
the slave the slave community, right.
Would be leaders, how to be a leader, you know, how to work with a group of people, how to deal with a group of people. And then one of the other most important things that the church did do at that time, you know, like I said, not the one that we know today, but this one, that one, fed people. On Sunday,
that's right.
You had a chance to, you knew that you were going to get a good meal. Because
they had mutual aid societies, and they had a good meal.
That's
I had a good friend. Since we talked about it, Dr. Rogers, from down near Wilson, North Carolina. But anyway, he's a Catholic, and I asked him one time, because he's very intelligent, and I couldn't see him being a Catholic. I said to his name was Hunter. I said, Hunter, how'd you become a Catholic, man? I said, you seem too intelligent to go for that Catholic stuff. He said, well, let me tell you what happened. And you reminded me, Dr. Rogers, when you said what you said. He said, he said the missionaries would come to my house and pick me up on Sunday. And he said, I know if I went to that Catholic church, and when church was over, he said, I would get me a good meal,
That's right.
I was not get, or I might get, I might not get at home. They fed us. And whenever you look at the Catholic missions around the world, they will always go in and feed and clothe the people to give them something they're missing. And then as a consequence, they will have you becoming a member of the church. So that's all. And like, I'm glad you mentioned Brother
Timothy. They still do that today. They still do it in Philadelphia.
You mentioned Brother Timothy in the Nation of Islam.
Right.
When I went to the mosque for the first time under Minister Kenneth X in Durham, North Carolina, I would go on Sunday because, man, when Minister Kenneth X would be teaching in the auditorium of the Page Auditorium on Pine Street in Durham, North Carolina, up those steps, up the cab stand, and he'd be teaching, but the sisters would be in the back fixing candied carrots and butternut squash and bean pies and smell it. And so as soon as you get out the mosque, whether you had the money or not, you could get a meal.
You can get a meal.
So are just tactics that they use to build an organization.
Right.
That's all. Look at Father Divine, since we're talking about black theology. Look at Father Divine.
That's
he had
right.
restaurants with all his churches.
Exactly. And I really want to do one of our discussions on one Tuesday night on that side of the theology of black folk, because there's a mystical side, Father Divine, Sweet Daddy Grace, and all of that. There's another flip side to all of this too that we need to be understood.
Hey, can I say something, Brother Bridges and Dr. Roddy?
And Prophet Jones and Elijah. Yeah, go ahead, Brother Tim.
Right. I was going to say, man, you said so much truth. You know, you said, because look, at the end of the service, you couldn't wait till the sisters they had the bean pie, they had the cream cheesecake.
Oh,
wait a minute, the cherry cheesecake, man.
Right.
You know what I'm saying, right? And you know, and they were so kind, right? They had like a little cup next to the bee suit, right? And that was the hook, man. You wanted it. You said they might wind up like $80 or $70, and they talked about the poor rate, but they didn't pay it because they was the cook.
That's right.
Everybody had to pay the poor rate except for the cook. But you know what, though? It was so good, man. It was so good. And it looked so clean because their garments was white. The mosque looked good.
Right.
And wait a minute. You had somebody... That was a new minister who opened up, and it could have been that night. It could have been Jerry Irons. It could have been one of Jeremiah's younger minister. It was always somebody. It could have came from North.
Right.
He could have came from North or New York. And
exactly.
He always threw down, you know. And you came full
right.
of knowledge. Full.
And you know the thing that I don't want to get away from. You know, our message for today, you know, in terms of this liberation fighting.
Dr. Rogers?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Bonice, so I just didn't want you to forget me.
Well, all right. I didn't know when you wanted to come back on. I know you said you were going to come back. But okay, I'll call you in just a minute. But anyway, I didn't want to get away from that. Because I think what David Walker was talking about in terms of that preacher and that church, he was dealing more with that one that had been appointed by the plantation owner. That's the one that he was dealing with, the one that had been made. And the one who, because, you know, there were a lot of physical churches long before Bethel AME. But these churches were owned by plantations. These were smokehouses. And the old plantation pig hog pen that they let the Africans use church on Sunday. And they would go to church. If you went and listened to that plantation preacher preach, you could even get a rooster. They would give you a rooster, and you could cook that rooster that day or chicken. That's where the chicken eating preacher comes from. As a reward for going and listening to that plantation preacher talk and tell you to obey those that alluded that they ain't really trying to hurt you, and talk about those Paulinian letters where Paul tells the captive guy to go back to his master. That went with a reward. And that's who David Walker's dealing with, I think, in a lot of sense. A lot of things that we're talking about, I think we have to put that in perspective. He was dealing with that type preacher. That preacher was set up. That was the preacher that Nat Turner was when he first started. He had to preach like that or else be persecuted or hurt or killed, you know, in order to do that. But that was an opportunity to get a little bit of air, a little bit of freedom. If you want to really understand that a little bit, there's an old book by a historian named John Blasingame called The Slave Community. And he talks about what that plantation church was like. And it helps explain, you know, how that system was used. And then another source, a very good source, is a lot of Paul Lawrence Dunbar's poems. He has a poem called The Antebellum Church, the Antebellum Sermon, where the preacher is preaching about liberation, but he has to stop every now and then and switch back because he said, I don't want y'all to go back and tell your masters what I said. I ain't talking about revolution. I'm talking about this. And he does that in Paul Lawrence Dunbar, recognizes that that was used quite often. So it's called The Antebellum Sermon. Take a look at that if you've never read that. You'll find that to be a very interesting piece that Paul Lawrence Dunbar wrote. But it shows you what the preacher had to do. He had to switch up because the one that was meeting outside in the creek talking about running away and doing all the stuff he was doing, that's a different church. That's not what David Walker's talking about. He's not talking about that church. He's talking about another kind of church. You know, he's talking about that one that was set up. So I think we have to put that in perspective. Okay, Sister Benicia?
Yes.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, you know, they say that, religion is the opiate of the masses, doesn't matter which one. And it's also said, which I so agree with, and I see with my eyes, and that's that religion is a deification of a culture. So it doesn't matter for me, that, and my observations, you know, being in church for many years and a part of other religions, it doesn't matter the religion. Black folk are going to do what we do. Islam could have been forced on us here in America, and we would have done what we do, which is gather, feed each other, take care of each other, regardless of what some of what the Bible was saying. And the other thing is that with Christianity, because it was forced on us, and it's a very, at this point, it's a very, and it, well, when it was forced on us, it was a very confusing book. I heard, you know, when Brother Bruce was talking about, you know, the teachings and whatnot were, you know, the origins, and in Africa, you know, which is true, we know that. But the white Jesus, you know, being forced on us was highly problematic. You know, I remember my grandparents and my mother and a lot of the elders just holding on to that white Jesus who they really felt was going to help them and save them. And he didn't, you know. And now we're learning that that white Jesus, we call him white boy on a stick, you know, was not a real entity. I mean, a real deity or whatever. It was not real. And so, you know, whether he existed or not as a man of color, you know, that's up for debate. But that white Jesus was not real. That is wrong. When you have these elders who can't read, don't know too much, and we perpetuate the lie, because we're so connected to emotionally, connected to something that's going to help us to stay sane, you know, with all of the trauma we were going through, that's wrong. So the point I want to make is that I have a lot to say, but there's not too much time now. But if the black church is going to revive itself and become relevant, the black church has to change. It has to change and start producing revolutionaries, get rid of all the Eurocentric teachings that have messed us up and confused us. You know, you have a Jeremiah Wright who's a powerful brother, and your brother, you know, Pastor Rogers, you know, his what he says is very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, you know, just a small part of, you know, the preacher community. And we don't even need any more preaching. We need real teaching that will, again, make us revolutionaries and not pacifists.
Mm-hmm.
Or else the church just won't be any good. And since we're, you know, under extermination, a 500-year extermination, we don't need anything that's not going to do us any good. And we don't need anything that's going to pacify us.
Mm-hmm.
Amen, Sister Benicia. Amen.
Ashe. So if the church is going to be relevant, get rid of the slave teachings. As a matter of fact, with all of the theologians, you know, that we have, I want to know if any black theologians have gotten together and written a black not liberation, but a black revolutionary Bible. Because one more, the last thing.
Right.
I was part of a member of a couple of churches that taught black liberation or liberation theology. And it was good because I was not liking, you know, all of the Eurocentric stuff that I was learning,
mm-hmm.
you know. And but it was still pacifist. Pray for your enemy. We're going to the Capitol, wherever, and we're going to pray. You know, a lot of people ain't down with that anymore.
Right.
So the church needs to evolve and start producing fighters and not prayers and forgivers and all that, because that's actually hurting us. When you forgive your enemy, you give your and when that's taught, you give your enemy permission to keep on kicking your butt and killing you.
The program, the station is going to cut us off. We're beyond the 9 o'clock. I really appreciate all of you for coming and listening. This is. It's a good start into this conversation, but we were basically honoring Black August Month and those liberation fighters who have stood up and not been afraid to back down. And clearly, David Walker was one of those. And so we wanted to give honor to him today. Take care. Have a very productive week. We'll see you next Tuesday at 7 o'clock right here on the Black Reality Think Tank.
I say,
peace
I
and
say.
Blessings.
I said,
peace and blessings, family.